going through the first portion of your book, it seems like a pretty bad story. And if this were an adventure about halfway through, I'd be wondering, well, how are these people going to get out of this? So how did our Constitution get broken in the way that you describe?
Well, let me just outline first what this first part of the book is trying to do. I think the title of the first part is Coming to Terms with Where We Are. Because a lot of people who are libertarians and, for that matter, conservatives think, gee, if only we get nine good justices in the Supreme Court, or even five, or if only we get a big enough margin in the House of Representatives and Senate and so forth. And I'm saying in the first five chapters, forget about it. If you're talking about better policy in education or welfare or something, sure, you can get there with those assets. But if you're talking about rolling back the power of government, you can't get there from here with the normal political process. And the Constitution is exactly illustrative of that. So in the 1930s, the Constitution was still very close to intact. There had been, you know, tweaks at the edges, but the enumerated powers were still a live issue. You could only do what the enumerated powers said. The Commerce Clause still meant an ordinary interpretation of the Commerce Clause. And over a period of just 5 years, from 1937 to, well, 6 years to 43, you had about half a dozen key cases where they cannot be reversed. Because once you said, oh, Congress may spend on the general welfare and is not limited by the enumerated powers, you have had since then the expansion of the federal government that the Supreme Court cannot reverse. If the Supreme Court, by a miracle, tomorrow said, gee, we're going to go back to the enumerated powers, 90% of the spending of the federal government would be unconstitutional. No Supreme Court can do that. No president can enforce that. So the Constitution's broken, can't go home again, come to terms with it, and let's think of something else.
And part of that is the regulatory state. Non-delegation as a doctrine is effectively dead.
Yeah, this was a direct result of the progressives of the early 20th century, led by Woodrow Wilson, who loved the idea of the disinterested expert who could solve policy problems without all these nasty pressures from politics, and they would give us the correct solution. Well, you couldn't get away with that for a long time because of what was called the non-delegation doctrine. All laws in the United States are to be enacted by the Congress, and so when the Congress passes legislation, it's supposed to have an intelligible principle that it gives to the government agencies to implement what Congress wanted. And in a case involving the National Broadcasting Corporation, the Supreme Court said, well, you know, a general instruction is good enough. So you can ask the regulatory agencies to make up regulations that are fair, that are equitable.
Good regulations.
Good regulations. And basically you're giving them carte blanche to write the regulations they want.
All right. So given that and the huge growth of the bureaucratic and administrative state where we have judges within departments who are effectively creating law, you advocate that business people, entrepreneurs in particular, simply stop obeying some of those laws.
That's right. Massive civil disobedience backstopped by private defense funds, or as Chip Miller over at the Institute for Justice said when I told him my plan, he said, so you want to pour gas, sugar into the government's gas tank. And that's what I want to do. I don't want to outline it in detail. I had to write a book, so it takes more time than I have here. But here's the essence of it. You go through the regulatory code and you identify a lot of regulations that are stupid and pointless. And I give specific criteria for stupid and pointless. But you identify regulations that when people ignore them, they aren't doing bad things. On the contrary, a lot of times it enables them to do their jobs better, to raise their families better, to cooperate with their neighbors in solving community problems better. And the way you can get away with this is because there's a dirty little secret about the regulatory state. It's like the Wizard of Oz. Caleb, you're old enough to have seen The Wizard of Oz, right? So this booming, commanding voice that scares the bejesus out of any individual citizen, because regulatory bureaucrats can and do say to small business people and to homeowners, you try to fight this and we'll ruin you because you can't afford to litigate against them. Suppose you had an attorney show up at the point at which the bureaucrat says, try to fight this and we'll ruin you. And the attorney says, we're going to litigate this person's case. We're going to litigate it to the max. We are going to tie you up as long as we possibly can. And when you find he's guilty of violating this stupid regulation, as you eventually will, we will reimburse his fine. What have you accomplished? And suppose this is happening on a big scale. Suppose you've got the equivalent of legal aid, which now helps poor people, that is available to ordinary citizens who are being senselessly harassed by the federal government. The legal staffs of these regulatory agencies are quite small. The number of inspectors are quite small. They cannot afford to have a whole lot of people ignoring their laws. They can't enforce them. And so that's what I want. I want a foundation that I call the Madison Fund that provides that kind of legal assistance. I want occupations to form defense funds. Caleb, what I really want is for us to treat the government as an insurable hazard, like tornadoes or locusts. And so you pay a small amount into your legal defense fund if you are a dentist, let's say, and if OSHA comes after you, they will take over your defense and drive the feds crazy.
Because you never know when government may strike.
That's it. It's just like a tornado. If you live in Tornado Alley down in Oklahoma, you do not build a tornado-proof house. You buy house insurance.
One of the things that I find attractive about this idea in particular is that sometimes providing a credible statement of a willingness to dig in for the long haul is all you need.
That's all you need. You're right. You aren't going to have to litigate thousands of cases. What you're going to have to do is establish credibility so that as soon as a bureaucrat comes after somebody and they get the word that the Madison Fund is going to take up the defense, all at once they have to say to themselves, oh, gee, do we really want to do this? Right now, the ordinary American knows that he or she cannot afford to fight. Now, all at once, the regulatory agencies have to face the necessity of making those choices if you've got a downside risk.
Just to clarify here, the people who are going to be defendants that the Madison Fund will jump in and rescue, in a sense, are people that have not harmed anyone through their civil disobedience.
Yeah, Caleb, I have a whole chapter in which I have criteria for deciding which regulations can and can't be avoided. But it comes down – this is the overarching criterion. If this case were to be fought out and publicized on a wide scale, would the overwhelming majority of ordinary Americans say they're on the side of the defendant? And there are all sorts of regulations of which that's true. So, for example, if you're not going to have an overwhelming majority, you want to avoid it. I think affirmative action is a mistake. I would like to see people get, you know, a relief in terms of the requirements of affirmative action. But that's not going to get overwhelming majority support if you litigate it. And so I would say stay away from everything that doesn't give you that overwhelming support. And over time, here's what I want to have as the result. I want the regulators to have to face up to the same thing that faces a highway patrolman on the interstate every day, where a majority of us are engaged in civil disobedience. Maybe you always obey the speed laws, but I got to tell you, I'm at 73 miles per hour in a 65 mile per hour speed zone, and I'm in the with the flow of traffic. The state troopers could technically arrest all of us who are doing that, but they don't. They arrest those who are going way over the speed limit or who are driving erratically. And the analogy is in sports is no harm, no foul. So that in an NBA basketball game, the officials do not call all the transgressions. If it doesn't affect action leading to a basket or preventing a basket, no harm, no foul. I want to have a regulatory system where the regulators are forced, kicking and screaming, into a situation where the only violations they go after are ones when they can really say, hey, this person did something that was harmful.
Now, if this idea got off the ground, there's one result that might be surprising that would be, I think, a positive surprise. And there's so much of regulation that is on the books at the federal level that simply has never been effectively challenged. And
yes.
And the government takes great pains in some cases to avoid those challenges getting before any judge, mm-hmm. Let alone a higher federal court.
They do that sometimes, but I'll tell you, another weakness of them is that they will sometimes be engaged in a really stupid enforcement, like the Sackett case that came before the Supreme Court a few years ago, where the EPA was claiming that this family was building a home on wetlands, which meets no reasonable criteria for wetlands. And it was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, where the Sacketts won 9-0. And you would have thought, doesn't the EPA realize that it doesn't have a leg to stand on? But they sort of mindlessly kept on defending their position. And that might be the route whereby we are going to get some things to the Supreme Court that are going to provide precedents that are going to make life much more difficult for the regulatory agencies.
And it's entirely possible that just the existence of this fund could change how regulators do their jobs.
Yes. I said the Wizard of Oz against a lone citizen. I want to pull back the curtain, as happened in the movie, and instead of this powerful Goliath, you have a little old guy with thinning hair and a microphone, and he's exposed as being weak and impotent. You know, I do not have a history of being optimistic about solutions. In fact, my standard laugh line in every speech is, I'm a libertarian. Libertarians don't do solutions. But in this case, I think this is feasible, and I think it could have an incredible impact.
And it's not violent.
It's not violent.
Right. Which is a great selling point if you're wanting to undermine a large chunk of government.
And it's based on the presumption that a lot of people who aren't libertarians are also fed up with ordinary people being senselessly harassed. And so we don't have to convert them to be libertarians, but I think we can appeal to something that they are already ready to believe.
You make an appeal in here to the cultural diversity that exists in the United States. You say that it's closer to the founding era than it was, say, in the 1950s when, as you say, that we were all watching the same news programs. Why is that relevant?
Well, there's lots of hysterical statements about the United States is entering into an unprecedented period because you're going to have a majority of the population will be non-white by mid-century, and somehow this is going to present unprecedented challenges. And, come on. In the 18th century, even when we were still all ethnically from the British Isles, the cultural differences among the Puritans and the Quakers and the Cavaliers and the Scots-Irish were at least as great as cultural differences among ethnic groups. Another thing is happening, apart from ethnic diversity, and Caleb, this is the real key, you now have cultural diversity whereby people on the left want to be left alone. So the cultures that now exist in Portland, Oregon, in Boulder, Colorado, and other places around the country are very distinctive. And suddenly it's not just conservatives who want to have, you know, the government stay out of their cultural practices. A lot of people on the left do. Marijuana laws, perfect example. Washington and state and Colorado passed laws that are simply unconstitutional. You know, federal law trumps state law. That's as basic as it gets in terms of constitutional jurisprudence. Department of Justice has backed off. It's not trying to enforce federal law because this is a liberal Department of Justice, and it's liberals who want to be left alone. That is a thin edge of a wedge that can work to wonderful effect in the future.
Good evening. This is Charles Murray. He's the W.H. Brady Scholar here at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of a great many books that have sparked national conversations and actually changed laws. He's arguably the most consequential social scientist alive today. I put the word arguably in there because I know there's some people in this room who would disagree and would like to argue it. And I'm Jonah Goldberg. I'm basically here because I was lied to about there being an open bar. So I guess sort of like a Pegasus, I'm going to try to have a very light footprint for a creature so large. Because everyone's here basically to see Charles. And to the extent anyone's here to see me, it's for the same reasons I go to NASCAR, to see someone spectacularly crash. So I'll try to be somewhere between Brian Lamb and William F. Buckley. I don't want to just sort of disappear into the woodwork like Brian Lamb, and I don't want to veer into excessive sesquipedalianism like my old boss. And we'll figure it out from there. My first question is a question I love when I'm on a book tour, and it is shocking. Shocking how rarely it is asked. Charles, what's your book about?
I think it shows the self-confidence I have gained with advanced age that I'm willing to put you on the same stage with me. because I know when Goldberg talks, I just want to sit back and listen to him. But I will tell you what the book's about. It is entitled Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission, because that is the theme. I thought people were saying they couldn't hear me, but that's not what they were saying out there. Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission, because that is the ultimate theme. This is not a book addressed across the aisle, as most of my books are, where I try to engage people from a wide range of political views with my argument. Rather, I am saying to people who, like me, are devoted to limited government, how can we restore, at least to some degree, the freedom that has been lost? The twin premises of the book are, first, a very depressing one, that the American project, as it was originally conceived, is effectively dead. By the American project, I mean the idea that people could be allowed to live their lives as they see fit, as long as they accord the same freedom to everyone else, and the function of the government is to provide a peaceful setting for those endeavors and otherwise to stand aside. That is essentially gone. We are still free in the same sense that Norwegians are free, that Germans are free, that Italians are free. And that's no small thing, but that wasn't what we meant by land of the free. What we meant was that Americans lived under a presumption of freedom, and a presumption that as long as they weren't hurting anybody else, they could do pretty much as they pleased. And that's gone. We now live under a presumption that we need permission. A lot of it is from the state and local levels. A very great deal of it is from the federal level. So that's the first premise. The second premise is that opportunities are opening for restoring the American project in a new incarnation. It won't be the same, but we can do a lot to once again become the land of the free in an important way. I feel that I had to start the book by making the case that the normal political process can't do what I want to do, because the book is about systematic civil disobedience and how it can be mounted. And civil disobedience is a serious thing. The rule of law is the foundation of civilization. You shouldn't go around breaking the law knowingly unless you have a really good reason to do it. And I spend 5 chapters opening the book in which I make that case. And they go like this. The Constitution is broken beyond repair. Doesn't make any difference if we get 9 Clarence Thomases on the Supreme Court or 9 Nino Scalias, because their hands are tied by a very untouchable constraint. Namely, if they were to try to reverse
the decisions of 1938 to 1943 that fundamentally changed the interpretation of key phrases in the Constitution, general welfare, the Commerce Clause, the rules under which the regulatory state can make up regulations. If they tried to change those, 90% of what the federal government does today would suddenly be unconstitutional. No Supreme Court can do that. It would never be enforced by a president. It would be the end of the Supreme Court. Second chapter, we live under an increasingly lawless legal system. I don't use the word lawless carelessly. At ground level, where we actually live from day to day, all sorts of things that go on do not correspond to our common sense notions of the rule of law, an objective set of things that reasonable people agree we must do. Rather, it corresponds to a complex game that bears little resemblance to the rule of law traditionally construed. Third chapter is the extra-legal nature of the entire regulatory state. I bet a lot of people in this room are as ignorant as I was when I started the book. I was amazingly ignorant about how the regulatory state works. It essentially is as if the police force were empowered to create laws and then to enforce them and to pick the judges and to pick the Court of Appeals. I mean, that's pretty much the way the regulatory state operates, and they make up these regulations independently of any specific mandate from Congress, except we want fair regulations. We want clean air. We want clean water. Fourth chapter, the systemic corruption of the federal government. All of these things, by the way, I'm giving you a telegraphic one- or two-liner, and then Jonah will grill me later in more detail where he feels most interested. Short statement here is, not that we have more dishonest legislators than we used to have, but if you look at operationally the way Washington goes about its business, it is indistinguishable from the way a kleptocracy operates. Strong statement. I'll leave it there. And finally, I get into the reasons that Mansur Olson elucidated, the famous economist Mansur Olson, about the sclerosis that is endemic in advanced welfare states. So, that having established basically in the first five chapters, I'm saying there is no hope of rolling back government through the normal political process. You can get better policies on education. You can get better policies on tax policy, on, you know, discrete policy issues. You can't roll things back. So that's when I get to the point of the whole book. Let's have systematic civil disobedience. By systematic, I mean that you don't just ignore the rules you don't like, but rather you go through a pretty complex process, again, one we can discuss during the questions, whereby you say, you know, here are certain kinds of regulations you can't ignore. You can are permitted to ignore. Let me tell you how the book came to be written, because it's a good illustration of what animated me. My wife and I have a friend who runs a business. I'm not going to go into any more detail than that. The point is, he was being harassed by the regulatory state and fined large amounts of money because he was not complying with various regulations that it was impossible for him to comply with. He was being given competing instructions from the government. And he finally said, I'm going to fight this in court. And the bureaucrat to whom he was talking said, try that and we will put you out of business. Well, when I heard that, as my wife will testify, I was so angry that I actually told her, I don't want to hear any more of this because I just can't stand it. And then all at once, I had first an image in my mind. Not making this up. This really happened. I had an image. I think it was on a horse in my original image. A guy in a pinstripe suit and a horse comes out of nowhere, taps the bureaucrat on the shoulder and says, we are taking this man's case. We are going to litigate it to the max, even though he's technically guilty of the violation. But in the course of you having to demonstrate that, you are going to wish you'd never taken this on, because we're also going to publicize it in ways which will embarrass your superiors and you. And at the end of the whole thing, when you finally levy a fine on him, we're going to reimburse it. This satisfied me a great deal, just thinking of this. And then I said, you can write a book. And so ultimately, I end up writing this book as a way of saying, we could systematically do this. If you had a foundation with a couple of $100 million, I'm not talking a little foundation, a place like Institute for Justice or the Pacific Legal Foundation or Competitive Enterprise do wonderful work in litigation, but they are doing selective cases where they are trying to have precedents that affect whole classes of cases. I'm talking about pouring sugar into the government's gas tank. I want to overload the regulatory enforcement apparatus, and I will simply assert right now that apparatus is not nearly as daunting as you think it is. It's daunting when it's directed against a single citizen. It's not an apparatus that can cope with a whole lot of challenges to it. The only way the regulatory state works is by getting overwhelmingly voluntary compliance, so that when the regulatory agency says you are in violation of such and such, you owe us $7,500, any smart business person or smart homeowner writes a check, knowing that they can't afford to fight it. And I want to create incentives whereby the regulatory state must back off. And I will summarize that in terms of an analogy. Right now, with regard to the regulatory state, we are in the position of somebody driving along the highway at 71 miles an hour when the speed limit is 65, and it's late at night, and it's a deserted stretch of highway. We can easily get stopped by a state trooper doing that. You know, he may be bored, he may have his quota of tickets to fill, and he'll do it. The very next morning, as we're driving along a busy stretch of the interstate at 71 miles an hour, 6 miles, miles over the speed limit, you're not going to get stopped because the whole flow of traffic is going 71 miles an hour. The troopers only stop people who are driving crazy fast, which occasionally is me, but they only stop you when you're driving crazy fast or you're driving erratically, and they enforce the law when something really, truly bad has happened. That's the way I want the regulatory state to function. I want them to adopt a no-harm, no-foul regulatory philosophy, whereby they only go after people who've actually done something that's wrong in some genuine sense. If you did nothing more than that, you would lift a huge regulatory fear that we all have to live under. So we all end up trying to comply with OSHA's rules or EPA's rules, even though we know the chances they're going to inspect us is relatively small, because we can't take the chance. Okay, Jonah opened up with the first question, and I warned him in advance, the first answer is going to be a lot longer than the others. But that is essentially what the book's about. I have more chapters after that, but we can get into that in the course of the discussion.
Okay, great. So first of all, I want to say that, like, whatever you think of Charles's Madison Project, which is this idea of this Institute for Justice on steroids. I mean, steroids doesn't even really cover it. It's more like it was exposed to gamma radiation and turns into the Hulk and runs across the countryside smashing things. I will say that the first third, having read a lot of these sort of summaries of what went wrong with the Constitution, how we lost the Constitution and all the rest, I can't recall a better, more accessible, and comprehensive summary of how the Constitution of the Founders was undermined during the Progressive Era and the New Deal. And it's really very well done, and we can get into that. And I'm sure, hopefully, there are some lawyers here who will tell me that no, the Constitution can be saved without the Madison Project, but I'll leave that for the legals in the group. The first thing that comes to mind when you talk about the Madison, this idea of selective civil disobedience, is the scene you often see in a lot of Westerns where you see a crowd of thugs and the one good marshal, right? And they all say, and the leader of the thugs says, he's only got a six-shooter and there are 11 of us. We can take him. And then the marshal always says, yeah, but who wants to be the first to die? How are you going to find people who are going to be willing to be, you know, thrown in jail, which is the very possible, maybe some might argue probable outcome of this strategy. And what are you going to do when the administrative state or the regulatory state, as you call it, refuses to lie down and keeps throwing people in jail if it doesn't bend? I mean, what is your tolerance level for mass incarceration of small businessmen and florists and all the rest?
The Leninist part of me says that would be great, because but in more practical terms, an awful lot of these challenges are of regulations that do not rise to the level of jail being a legitimate threat. I'm talking about, I'll give a couple examples that I have in the book. This is a brick company. And by the way, I should footnote here Philip Howard, who's written some wonderful books. The Death of Common Sense, I think, is the one this comes from. He has a recent one that's come out called The Rule of Nobody, which is also sensational. Anyway, you got a brick company, and they are being fined. And here are just a couple of them. They have railings, but we're in exposed places, you know, above the shop floor, but their railings are only 40 inches high instead of 42 inches high. That's $7,500. They failed to have a sign saying poison on a shed. The shed contained beach sand. But in the list of poisonous substances, OSHA, in its infinite wisdom, has decided beach sand is a poison because in certain grinding operations, it can cause, perhaps, certain kinds of respiratory problems, none of which apply to the brick company. They are told to replace their entire conveyor belt system so it has an automatic shutoff at many thousands of dollars of cost, even though the conveyor belt is already partitioned off from access to people and there's no problem to be done. The OSHA is not going to try for jail time if people ignore those regulations. And part of the Madison Fund that I'm talking about, well, a key part of it is that it will reimburse people who are fined. And my friend Steve Williams, Judge Emeritus on the Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, who's not here tonight, but was really helpful, I asked him, is that legal to reimburse people for these? And he got back to me with, not always it's not going to be, but a lot, of, you know, and you, it will have to be litigated, but most of the time it is legal to reimburse these things. So people can be made whole in terms of that. They are going to have the hassle of sort of having this legal action done on their behalf, and that's not trivial, but they're not going to end up with a bill.
But what if, I mean, so if I have my 40-inch railing, which is obviously a sign of anarchy, and the state says I have to raise it to 42 inches, they fine me. I was under the impression that the fine was also in conjunction with an order to raise it 2 inches.
Yeah.
If I refuse to raise it 2 inches, and they say, dude, you really got to raise this 2 inches, and I keep refusing it, don't at some point men with guns come to my house and say, you're in trouble?
In all seriousness, to the extent that that starts to happen, point number one would expect that there is somebody within OSHA who says, we don't want to go there.
Right.
We just want to pretend. We're just going to pretend this is. We're going to pretend that they changed it to 42 inches. We don't want to make our stand with this kind of case. I would argue that is the plausible thing that will happen an awful lot of the time. However, let's go to the ultimate aspect of your question. Do you have to have people who are willing to go to jail if it comes to that? And the answer is yes, you do. Then the question is, do we have such people? I don't know for sure that the answer is yes. I get the sense that there are. The certainty of jail, that's a tougher thing. The possibility of jail, I think there are a lot of people who are willing to do that. We will find out, I suppose. But the degree of anger out there, real anger at the way the government is getting in their face when the government doesn't have any business doing there, it's real. You have a lot of really pissed off people.
Yeah, no, I run into them all the time. But why, let me ask, isn't it to a certain extent this call for civil disobedience? And, you know, obviously my heart is with you. I'm trying to bring around my head. But isn't to a certain extent this, it's less fighting back and more a sort of sign of surrender on democracy? I mean, we had lots of laws on the books that were, I would dare say, even more tyrannical and oppressive than the 42-inch railing law or the sand shed poison law, things like Jim Crow. We had slavery, but that's a bad example because there was a war and I had to fix that. But we had, women's suffrage movement. We had all sorts of movements to remove bad, evil, and in some cases evil laws by arousing mass democracy. Why the immediate shortcut to getting pizza parlor owners and lawyers to join hands and sing "We Shall Overcome"? I mean, why can't we do it as a mass democratic movement?
Here we get to the chapters 4 and 5 on the systemic corruption of the process and what in the sclerosis of democracy. A lot of you probably in the room have heard of Mansur Olson. He wrote a pair of seminal books, The Logic of Collective Action, back in the 1960s. He followed that up with, I think it's The Rise and Fall of the Decline of Nations. Putting it real quickly, this is something that is inherent in advanced societies, and he uses the sugar subsidy as an example. The sugar subsidy is absolutely ridiculous. The Americans pay twice the world price for sugar in order to placate a small number of sugar growers. We have used democracy to try to get rid of the sugar subsidy a whole bunch of times. And in fact, most recently, a couple of years ago, you initially get a vote to do so. But the fact is the sugar growers really, really care about preserving the sugar subsidy, and they are willing to reward legislators who vote with them and punish those who don't, whereas the rest of the country cannot be mobilized because our interest in getting rid of the sugar subsidy is just too diffuse. Well, you multiply that kind of asymmetry between people who really care about holding on to their special interest and the very large group of people that have a very diffuse reason for not liking it, and you end up with the kind of gridlock we have now. So that rolling back large chunks of the federal regulatory code would involve Congress saying, we are going to have a grand solution that steps on the toes of 5,000 of our largest campaign contributors. That's not going to happen. There is, I don't ever say this as explicitly in the book as I'm going to try to say it now. There is a sense in which we are stuck with this blob called for the federal government, which apart from the legitimate functions that it better do well, is basically a dead weight on us that we are learning to live with. And the optimistic part of the last part of the book is basically not that we're going to reform it, it's that we're going to work around it. That's a very pessimistic statement, but the reason I spend those first 5 chapters trying to destroy your hope, I'm sorry that you got through them with a shred of optimism left. I did my best.
Well, my motto is cheer up, for the worst is yet to come. So, as you know, because you've heard me talk about it a bunch of times, I'm sort of fascinated with Joseph Schumpeter's understanding of the new class, which Irving Kristol wrote a great deal about as well, which borrowed from James Burnham and the managerial revolution. And the basic gist of it is that a lot of the problems that beset America are the product of affluence, that you have rich robber barons who don't get much education. They create vast amounts of wealth, and then as a hedge against failure, they overeducate their kids. Their overeducated kids become lawyers. Maybe the next generation, they become intellectuals. I think Warren Buffett's son is a poet. And the ultimate problem that you get is that you have a class of people who basically become the storytellers of a civilization. And they become, in effect, this, what Burnham called the managerial class, this inchoate group of intellectuals, storytellers, lawyers, educators, social workers who have glommed on to the administrative state that comes out of Woodrow Wilson and all that. And they're in effect a priesthood. And their close cousins, I would argue, are the bureaucrats. They see their interests aligned.
They're apparatchiks.
Right. They're almost perfectly stated apparatchiks of the state. And the intellectual classes see themselves as beneficiaries and kindred spirits of these guys. And so part of my concern is, you know, this idea that you're going to drain the resources of the of these bureaucracies hinges on this idea that their concern is overwhelmingly with financial resources and limited manpower and all of the rest, when I think that human nature is much more inclined to care about status and power. And the approach that you advocate in many ways is a, I mean, I think this is a fair description, is a silver bullet at the beast, right? I mean, you were trying to destroy this system. And it seems to me that if they actually engage and take your argument seriously and this endeavor gets up and running, they will move hell and high water to kill it and to protect what is theirs. Because their interests are deeply bound up, not in the maintaining the sugar subsidy, but in their divine right to be the arbiters of what kind of civilization we're in, the kind of people who get to decide the story of our culture, who get to tell us about the role of government. And so it's not obvious to me that you can actually just gum up the works of these bureaucracies if they actually understand the threat that you're trying to pose. And you put it all in writing.
Well, let's go back to the origins of when this administrative state was looked upon with great hope and optimism. And by the way, liberal fascism, which is Jonah's book, was for me a major source in understanding the progressive era, and I got insights from that I had never had before. And one of the insights is this. I always thought of the progressive era as being a kind of good government. You know, you get rid of the bad meat packers and you have more direct democracy. And it was in part that. But there was also this strain of which Woodrow Wilson was a passionate advocate, which drew from the Germans and said, experts, we now have this thing we've never known before in history. We have experts who know the truth, the objective truth about how to solve certain problems, and what we do is we give them a buffer from the political messy stuff so they can make these fair, disinterested decisions free from checks and balances. I'm not putting words into Woodrow Wilson's mouth. I'm virtually quoting him, drawing quotes that Jonah had in the book. Well, the initial, you know, you had something like the Forest Service, where you actually did have experts in forestry who actually did for some years do a lot better job of managing the nation's forests. And that kind of task was suited for experts. We have degenerated a long way from that. So now you have what I agree is the priesthood. And these are the people in academia. They are the people in journalism a great deal. They really do exist. But their apparatchiks are a different kind of animal. There's a very good book called A Government Ill-Executed by a guy named Leiter. Does anybody in the audience? Paul Leit. Where it's an analysis, a very dispassionate, nonpartisan analysis of what it's like in the federal bureaucracy. And the answer is you have people who really like their job security and people who are very happy with their pay, because if you're not talking about the top levels of the bureaucracy, people in the bureaucracy get really well paid. So they like that. And in every other way, they're a deeply demoralized bunch. And so it's not the case that given the kind of challenges they're going to be given by my lawyers in the Madison Fund, that these guys are going to be saying, we will work 80 hours a week as long as it takes to fight back this. You want people that want to put in their 8 hours max with as little effort as possible and are not the shock troops that the priesthood needs to defend themselves. It's a case – well, let me just give you a few nuts and bolts so you know I'm not blowing smoke when I say the enforcement capability isn't that great. Let's go back to OSHA again, which is one of the best-known offenders. OSHA, even when you add in the state-level inspectors that collaborate with it, you're talking about 2,200 inspectors, and you're talking about 8 million workplaces over which they have responsibilities. So this is not a huge enforcement capability. You will have to bring hundreds of cases to start to get them overloaded, but you aren't going to have to bring tens of thousands of cases. And furthermore, if the Madison Fund does its job right, it's going to be kind of the same thing that the regulatory agencies do now. Now the regulatory agencies hit you with your $7,500 fine, and you write the check because you don't want to get involved. All at once, you're putting the bureaucrat in exactly that same position. He's brought a violation of a regulation, and he wants a compliance order, and all at once he hears the Madison Fund is going to take this guy's case. And he has a real incentive at that point to say, well, maybe not, and back off and so forth. So you do not have – the priesthood will be trying – whipping – they'll be whipping the apparatchiks furiously as the troika tries to go through the snow. But I think I'm mixing up my metaphors here. but
I just like the whipping the apparatchiks part, so you had me there.
but the point is that this is not a highly motivated opponent. On the contrary, it's a very demoralized opponent in most of these agencies.
Just for those of you who know, we were going to have Charles Murray bingo cards made up, and Mansur Olson was going to be on there, and cognitive stratification, which we haven't hit yet, but whipping the apparatchiks was one of the ones I really should have put on there. We want to move to Q&A in just a little bit, but I understand that as a guy who wrote a wonderful book called What It Means to the Libertarian, What It Means to Be a Libertarian, this is probably not a devastating critique, but isn't this profoundly unconservative, right? And I think that has a couple implications. One is philosophical, and a colleague of mine reminded me of the speech that Abraham Lincoln, admittedly who was a lawyer, gave at the Lyceum when he was a young lawyer. He said, "Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his posterity swear by the blood of the Revolution never to violate in the least particular the laws of the country and never to tolerate their violation by others. Let reverence for the laws become a political religion of the nation. Bad laws, if they exist, should be repealed as soon as possible. Still, while they continue in force for the sake of example, they should be religiously observed, because reverence for the Constitution and its laws is indispensable for preserving our political institutions and retaining the attachment of the citizens." So there's a philosophical problem, right? There's also the political problem. While I am sure there are hotbeds of hot-blooded libertarians who love this idea, and I'm sure there are hotbeds of conservatives who love this idea, the average conservative voter is actually pretty conservative. And you tell them, oh, we're going to gin up this big organization to foment lawbreaking and civil disobedience. It's not entirely clear to me that you're going to get the kind of public democratic support that you kind of still need, even if you're going to do this through the courts. So take your pick on either of those.
Well, the first point is, you're right, it's very unconservative. The violation of laws is momentous. I'm happy to say that Bea Crystal is in the audience today, and I sent her a copy of the book a few days ago, and the inscription was, "To be with some trepidation, Charles," because I wasn't at all, and I at this very moment, I'm going to find out after the presentation, I'm not at all sure that Professor Crystal is going to be happy with that very aspect of it.
Too late to call back the book.
It's too late to call back the book. But let me also then go back from the Lyceum speech to another document that I'm not quoting exactly, but when I say that government should not be changed for light and transient reasons, And but when governments betray their duty, as I'm now paraphrasing, it is not only the right but the obligation of people to rise up against that government. I feel it incumbent upon me to make the case that these are not light and transient reasons for taking this strategy, but that it is in fact true that the government we have now is so far removed from the government that commanded Abraham Lincoln's allegiance that we are justified in taking steps to change it. So, take your question seriously. I think we have an extremely serious problem that does not lend itself to solution by anything else except trying to take back some portion of the freedom, the God-given freedom that has been taken from us.
And on the political question, I mean, what if...
Here is my... It's not a complete answer to your question, but I talk at great length about the criteria for deciding which laws can be ignored. For example, I say you can't have civil disobedience for the tax code. Tax code's terrible. There's many unfairnesses. But principled civil disobedience with regard to the tax code is operationally indistinguishable from cheating on your taxes.
Right.
So you can't go that route. But aside from all the specific criteria I lay out, I say over and above all is this rule, that if this case that you're defending, where the guy has ignored the regulation, gets publicity, an overwhelming majority of Americans who hear about it will be on the side of the defendant. So that is a culling rule. You only pick things where ordinary Americans see what the government is doing and saying, that's really stupid or that's really wrong.
Okay. I meant to bring this up earlier about the political class thing. I was talking about the rise of the new class and the intellectuals and the capacity for bureaucrats to get into mission creep. For some reason, I was reminded of the new head of NASA early in the first Obama term, when he was asked what his number one priority was. And I know you wrote a book about NASA with your lovely wife, the Apollo program. His response was reaching out and building bridges with the Muslim world.
I know.
Which
it's hard to believe this.
Which is, it's like out of The Onion. And but it is a great sign of how you can get how the storytellers can corrupt the bureaucracy in all sorts of ways. I think I'm going to be incredibly disciplined and move this to the Q&A portion. We have about 20 minutes, which was the plan. My only request is that you make all of your statements in the form of a question, and we'll have at it. Yes, Martin.
Hi, I'm Martin Worcester. I work for many people. First off, on the subject of Peter Buffett, let me just say he isn't just a poet. He's a pop singer and writes sort of new age pop psychology books about how awful it is to have too much money. Think Rod McEwen. Mr. Murray, I've read you for 30 years. You've always had a dark view of the world.
Unlike you, Martin.
Say something that will cheer me up.
I'll be happy to. Uber. In Uber, we have the first of what will be many, many examples. Many. We can't even imagine. Who could imagine Uber 15 years ago? Of ways in which we are going to have workarounds that stymie the overreaching state. I assume almost everybody in the room knows how Uber works, okay? Because it's here in Washington, D.C., which is a classic case because Uber just came in and started operating, which is what it does. It doesn't say, please let us in on your taxi monopoly that the city council and the taxi companies have set up. They just start operating, and then the council was against it, was going to get rid of it, until they realized Uber was already so popular, there was a political price to be paid if they tried to get rid of it. Uber is it also has deep pockets. So the government can't go after Uber hoping just to overwhelm it with money, because Uber got more money than any city government's got. So that kind of thing is going to become increasingly prevalent. Remember what I said a few minutes ago, that you have this kind of lump. It's dysfunctional. It's incompetent in a lot of cases. We're just going to work around it. That's what I had in mind. But the really optimistic thing for me is to think ahead 200 years. I know all about Keynes and what he says about the long run, but still, here's my proposition to you. 200 years from now, the information technology revolution, which has transformed our lives already, will have gone into realms we can't possibly imagine. The amount of information that will be available to people is just going to be incredible. Also, we will have learned all sorts of things about all sorts of other aspects of human nature down to the genetic level, which is going to take away a lot of the stupidity of contemporary sociology departments. We're going to be able to make much better social policy on the basis of, here's how human beings really flourish. Here's how they really live happy lives. It is inconceivable. Oh, one other thing. We're also going to be much, much richer. The fact is, you don't need limited government to have economic growth. And short of Soviet stupidity on the part of America's leaders, which is not impossible but not probable, we're going to be vastly richer than we are now. It is inconceivable to me that 200 years from now, we will still be thinking, you know, the way to live our lives is to have armies of bureaucrats enforcing minutely prescriptive rules about how we live our lives. I just don't think that's going to happen.
You'll be dead then, Martin, but still. from all the way in the back. Make the guys with the mic run.
Sorry, John Graham, National Center for Policy Analysis. I shouldn't have identified myself because my question is going to get me in trouble. But it's about, I really respect your perspective, but I'm thinking about, I read National Review all the time, so I'm up to my eyeballs in the great gay wedding cake photographer catering wars. And we seem to be in a position right now where you don't have the ability to be civilly disobedient. Your ability to even civilly non-perform is stifled because they will come and provoke you when you're minding your own business and crush you immediately for not performing according to what the government wants you to do. I was just wondering your comment on that.
Of course, the pizza guys, how many hundreds of thousands of dollars of contributions have they gotten? There's some civil society at work, and I'm not saying that's going to happen every time. I actually refer to that in the book, and this is before a lot of these things had come up. A side effect of a lot of cases of civil disobedience in which ordinary people are obviously right and the government is obviously overreaching, I think could have a spillover effect. And what I would like that spillover effect to be, that once again, when somebody doesn't want to bake a wedding cake for a gay wedding, that the response of people is, well, it's a free country, a phrase you don't hear very often anymore. I take your point about what's going on now with the kind of ferocious suppression of free speech. I think that is approaching the same level that it would be if a government starts throwing people in jail for having railings 2 inches short. We are getting very close to a point where an awful lot of ordinary Americans are saying this is ridiculous. I'm kind of optimistic about this one, too.
Eric in the back.
Yeah.
Please wait for a mic.
Is it necessary to have civil disobedience that goes into law breaking? If you think of the criminal justice system, if everyone arrested demanded an actual trial, the system would collapse because it's predicated on having some 90% or more settled through plea bargains. What if anyone where you required the bureaucracy to jump through every one of its own hoops as a way of exhausting it?
That's a very nice point. One of the things that's very clear to me, I just had some people in talking to me about taking first steps toward organizing a real functioning Madison Fund. I have gotten a very surprising amount of emails already about people who are seriously interested in being committed to it. Well, one of the things that's going to happen if we start thinking seriously about this are all sorts of additional strategies of exactly the kind you raised, where you can have somebody advise, let's say my friend who wanted to fight it in court and was told we'll ruin you. It may very well be that he can start getting advice that says, you know, you don't actually have to spend a whole lot on lawyers. Here are steps A, B, C, and D you can take simply to require the government to file these forms and so forth that won't really require you to do much of anything and are going to make them really irritated because it's going to put a lot of work on them. That's the kind – I really want to start out this with a kind of Saul Alinsky development for libertarians, whereby we and I will use the phrase again, all the ways in which we can pour sugar into the government's gas tank when it is engaged in activities that are arbitrarily and capriciously interfering with our ability to live our lives as we see fit.
What has Arthur Brooks done to AI that Charles Murray has described himself as a Leninist and sings the praises of Saul Alinsky here at AI? It's terribly disturbing. Yes, sir.
So what's the end result sort of the Madison Project? Is it simply that these bureaucracies stop enforcing arbitrary regulation, or do they just sort of wither up and die? Is it sort of you have a bureaucracy that's just no longer functioning and sort of is still consuming sort of public resources, or does it actually disappear?
No, assume that you still have exactly the same number of people employed by the bureaucracies. You still have the same regulations on the books, for that matter, but that a very large chunk of the Federal Code of Regulations is known to be de facto unenforceable. And the regulatory agencies know if we go after this, the damn Madison Fund will come after us and say, yeah, we're going to defend the guy, and we don't want to do that. You will simply have a whole lot of deterrence. But the apparatus, at least for a while, will remain in shape. I will say that in the book, I have a couple of subsequent steps whereby there are plausible changes in Supreme Court jurisprudence that would have a much more structural effect on the regulatory state. Those would be icing on the cake. The initial effects I have would leave the regulatory state in place in terms of its cost of manpower and things like that.
Yes, sir, over here.
Okay, you can call on people if you have the...
No, I'm enjoying having you do all this. It's very restful to have you on the stage.
So if I were a cunning government bureaucrat, and I use a subjunctive, fortunately I'm not a government bureaucrat, but why wouldn't I say, okay, you know what? I'm going to charge you for continuing violation of the 40-foot fence. You don't have to replace it. But every day you're in violation, I'm charging you $7,500, and I will happily accept the Madison Foundation's check for that violation a year down the line. And so now what we have is hundreds of millions of dollars going from the conservative citizenry right into government coffers, where who knows what they're going to do with it then. Have you considered that possibility?
No. it's a very interesting, but you know what it reminds me of? What it reminds me of is the Sackett case that came up a few years ago. And the Sackett case, for those of you who don't know, this is a family that wanted to build a house on a two-thirds of an acre that was sandwiched between a row of lakefront houses and a paved road. And this two-thirds of an acre was deemed to be wetlands, and they were not allowed to build. What the Sacketts won from the Supreme Court was the right to have their case heard without accumulating potential fines of millions of dollars, because they were racking up at $65,000 a day or whatever. That was kind of similar, where the regulatory agency was putting, for a minor violation, was putting a family at risk of utter financial ruin. Now, you've raised an interesting strategy, and if I were the Madison Fund, I think I would probably take that and make that my poster child. That here is this violation of a regulation which is very trivial, and they are using the power of the government to try to extract this absolutely absurd amount of money. It's a shakedown. And that's I'd go into public press with it, because legally maybe they could continue to do it. But I think it's like throwing people in jail. The government, if it to the extent it is overreacting, it's creating more revolutionaries rather than fewer. Now the Viet Cong comes into... I really have. Something's happened to my sensibility, I think.
Yeah, it's a little disturbing. Mark, back there?
And we have this woman who's had her hand up there.
First off, I want to say that I've already read the book, and it's excellent. And I really wanted to echo what Jonah said about how the first third of the book being just a tremendous explanation for what went wrong. I fully plan on having both my children read it as soon as they get to high school and are capable of understanding that. And I think that alone will ensure that they have my politics. But I wanted to ask you about one issue that you kind of dance around a bit in the book, which is civil service reform. It seems to me a lot of the problems of the regulatory state are directly tied to the fact that we have, you know, 1.5 million federal bureaucrats in this area making 130 grand a year. But it also seems to me that there's an actual political potential to do something about it. With the IRS scandal and all these other things happening, and plus when, you know, American citizens hear, that these guys are literally making double the private sector average and all these other things, it seems like there'd be a real political potential to pit, you know, ordinary citizens against the federal bureaucracy, which they don't like anyway. Have you considered that possibility?
Well, in the second to the last chapter, or last chapter, I think it is, I talk about ways in which there might be alliances across political divide for certain kinds of policies. And what I was thinking of especially was reconsideration of public service unions. And to me, the big vulnerable point there is not so much the federal public service unions, because that's kind of invisible in everyday life. But think of all the cities where the potholes aren't fixed, where the police cars are out of date or they aren't well maintained, where schools don't have enough textbooks and good ones, but they have cops that are making really good salaries and retiring after 20 years, and teachers making really good salaries these days. You can make six figures as a teacher, by the way, in certain big city school systems. And in effect, you've had public service unions which have been negotiating with the very people that they've elected through their political support, which means that they have extracted larcenous amounts of money, which is not available to fix potholes. Seems to me that this is so obvious in so many cities that this is where the potential for public arousal is possible. And if you could get rid of public service unions, you could have huge reforms at the city and state levels. Going after the federal bureaucracy, it's harder for me to see what is the visceral issue that you're going to coalesce widespread political support around. Whereas potholes and bad schools, even though you're spending $20,000 per student, those are pretty visceral.
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your presentation. I just wonder if you can address the people who lost their liberties. First of all, is that all of regulation is created or made by the people, whether you are in the government or not in the government. So you, the government, is a sort of just only half of the pictures. So I just wonder if you have those people who are doing wrong things, whether in the regulatory agencies or government commission, and whether the people who just abuse the law or even violation of law or constitution.
Government officials who abuse or violate the law?
You don't need a government officials. Just as a financial institution who disobey the law, fraud, and crime against normal citizens. So these type of things, whether you have information or compilation or a complaint or comments on agency who are supposed to enforce the law. Okay. Suppose you file a complaint to the Department of Justice and they do nothing, instead they harass you.
I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
You want me to rephrase it?
Insofar as you're talking about people breaking criminal law.
People who break the criminal law is not a citizens. A citizen.
Oh, you're
are
talking
harassed.
About non-citizens.
No. They are all citizens, all the people, whether they're citizen or anybody. It doesn't mean one person is harassed. They say, for instance, one person whose money was taken away or whose house was taken away by financial institution or by the IRS, they're related to that. So when a citizen who complained to a DOJ or a housing agencies, they do nothing. Instead, they harass you.
Oh, okay. I'm afraid, ma'am, you're talking about specific problems that you may well have encountered. But I'm sorry, I can't speak to those usefully, okay?
No, I just wonder if you know the information, that's all. All I have to do is whether the Department of Justice has the information of how many complaints they filed.
No, I'm sorry, I don't have that information.
Oh, in the back there?
So thank you very much for your book and for this talk. It's been very interesting. So my question relates to kind of trying to understand in your own mind, is there a relative gravity of the offenses committed by overly intrusive local ordinances or state level versus federal levels? So I'm just wondering that so often between conservatives and libertarians, we have debates about is federalism a good thing always, because you can have horrible regulations or laws on a state level, on a local level. But conservatives tend to have a bit more respect, usually, for federalism and how we can give more license on the local and state level. So I'm wondering, in this pursuit of trying to get rid of overly intrusive laws and regulations, do you see the federal government as being the larger offender? And do you think values of federalism and the comparative value between a very local and accountable institution like a school board or something having power over your lives versus somebody in Washington, does that play into your thinking as far as where we should have a targeted effort?
When you've got 2 minutes to go, you always get a question like that, which is incredibly complicated. It's a great question. Real quickly, the rationale for an awful lot of federal supremacy over state regulations has been the prevention of local tyrannies. So that the federal government was able to intervene when you had Jim Crow, when you had lynchings, when you had a company town in which people were being abused. That was always for me the weakness of localities, that you could have local tyrannies operating with impunity. Short statement here is that is completely obsolete. That there is nothing that the local television news station relishes more than a corrupt official or a corrupt company or something they go out and do an expose of. We have reached an information age which, among other things, has pretty much obviated a lot of that function of federal supremacy. Second short point is that whereas there are really onerous regulations at the state and local levels, the federal government has never shown any capacity or interest whatsoever as serving as the protectors of the population against those onerous regulations and so forth. And so in that sense, I don't see a danger in federalism in the sense that you lose anything good that the government's been doing with regard to holding back bad local regulation, which does not mean that local regulation should not be just as subject to the kind of civil disobedience as federal regulation.
You want to wrap it or you want to do one more?
I think that probably we've kept people for an hour and it's dinner time. And
I want to thank you all for coming. I want to thank Charles. There will be a book signing out this way, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It'll be right here. So Dr. Murray is going to stay to sign a few books. If everyone could just get in a single file line right here, we'll put a table in front of him. And wine and cheese are available in then.
And that's Caroline Kitchens, who both Charles and I follow obediently. So thank you all very much.
That was fun. Lots of fun.